against Lebanon is a much bigger issue. Their ultimate goal in the last couple of decades seemed to have been detaching Hezbollah from the Lebanese political scene. Maryam Saleh, Beirut.
As Afghanistan is struggling with a wide range of problems, the country's officials warn against the plots hatched by Afghanistan's enemies to wreak further havoc on it. In a conference in the capital, Kabul, Taliban's acting minister of enjoining good and forbidding wrong said that discord has been a big threat to Muslim world even from the very beginning of Islam, adding that one of Afghanistan's invaders' goals has been to sow sedition among different Muslim sects in the country.
During the invasion years, the enemies did whatever they wanted in our country. One of their goals was to deepen the differences among our people. This conspiracy has always been used against Muslims throughout history. And if we don't remain united, our enemies will again take control of Afghanistan.
During the conference, Muslim scholars stressed the need for solidarity and tolerance. They added that if Muslims stay aware and united, no one can invade their soil or they don't need to beg foreigners.
Muslim unity should not remain in slogans. People and nations should practically implement it. Islamic governments are obliged to bring Muslims together. Today's critical situation in our country is deeply rooted in the discord created by the Western countries.
We believe that the U.S. and the Zionist regime are trying to weaken Muslims. Westerners are afraid of the spread of Islam. To stop its progress, they have already hatched various plots, including the formation of Takfiri groups.
After taking power, the Taliban reached to different groups and ethnicities and assured them of protecting their rights and providing a safe haven for all Afghans. But as observers say, it remains to be seen what the future holds for the country. Muslim scholars hope that the withdrawal of foreign troops from Afghanistan paves the way for solidarity and tolerance in the country. At the same time, they warn of divisive plot by Islam's enemies. Rahmatullah Baghban, Kabul.
Last week, the Biden administration said that it is considering giving $450,000 per person to immigrants separated at the border. However, there are still 1,727 children yet to be reunited with their families, representing 33% of all those identified as separated from their parents by DHS under the Trump administration's zero-tolerance policy, a clear violation of human rights.
Essentially due to the racism on the part of the United States and how they resolve the problem. So, for example, the border crisis from Canada is very differently handled than the one that happens from the U.S.-Mexico border. And there's also this lack of dignity rights that are afforded those who are from the global south in terms of how they want to seek entry into the United States.
Many experts agree that the United States has failed to help Latin American countries to have strong, transparent public institutions with less corruption. Another problem is that some Central American countries have the highest rates of poverty and violence in Latin America, which requires greater investment to create jobs and combat gangs that terrorize Central Americans who end up fleeing to the U.S.
I believe what hinders that relations of the United States with their southern neighbors is a history of bad relations, right? Even if you want to build on good relations now, relations that better the conditions in those countries so that these people do not need to emigrate from their countries.
More than 60% of immigrants have resided in this country for more than a decade and have more than 4 million children born in the United States. Despite all discriminations and difficulties imposed by different governments, they are the backbone of the agriculture, construction, and hospitality sectors, representing 5% of the workforce. If the promises of the United States to make more than three times as many people as full citizens comes to fruition, this could be open the door to one of the most important demographic changes in modern American history. By pulling millions of Latin immigrants out of the shadows and as potential voters. Reporting from Miami, Ronnie Corvello.
Israeli voiced the knob of a UN human rights report on the crimes committed by Tel Aviv against Palestinians has sparked harsh criticism in the Gaza Strip. Palestinians described the move as a clear violation of their rights and considered it a green light to the Israeli forces to go further with their crimes against Palestinians.
What Israel's envoy did in the United Nations General Assembly serves as a slap in the face of those who always support Israel. The move exposed the true nature of Israel. Palestinians will keep defending their rights despite Israeli escalations.
Israel's envoy to the UN tore a copy of the annual report of the Human Rights Council, mimicking his predecessor. A UN committee held a special hearing at the General Assembly, and its president handed over the annual report to all member states exposing the proto-Israeli crimes.
Human rights groups here condemn what the Israeli envoy did. They consider it as an obvious underestimation of all human rights and international laws. Israel considers itself above law. This is due to the international apathy towards Israel's previous crimes.
The UN report presented the findings of an investigative committee investigating the Israeli occupation's offensive on Gaza that killed hundreds of Palestinians, including women and children, as well as the regime's illegal settlement expansion in the West Bank. Palestinians here say by tearing up the UN human rights report, Israel underestimates all international standards, adding that this action reflects the arrogant nature of the regime. Palestinians called on the international community to make serious actions and hold Israel accountable for the crimes committed against Palestinian people. Ruba Shavit, Gaza.
Keep it in the ground. Protesters outside the venue of the UN Summit on Climate Change in Glasgow, giving world leaders a taste of what's to come in the coming days.
Protests have already gotten underway at the same time as the COP26, and the protesters have come here from far and wide to send one clear message to the world leaders. The time for talk is over. It is time for action, and we want it now.
A look at the most recent extreme weather events around the world supports that sense of urgency. From the bushfires in Australia, to the heat wave in icy Canada, to the forest fires in Turkey, and the floods that hit India and Europe earlier this year.
What more proof is needed, you know? And this is just the tip of the iceberg. It's only beginning now. It's going to get worse as the temperature goes up. So, you know, I'm here to say, hey, let's do something now.
Some of the world's biggest polluters, such as the U.S., China, and Europe, have set ambitious targets for the next 30 years to keep global warming in check. The protesters say setting goals is one thing, implementing them is another.
History has shown us that these world leaders are doing very little to actually reduce emissions. They're more interested in creating capitalist markets that save the economy as opposed to reduce emissions and save the planet. And it's going to be us putting pressure on them, not the solutions that they're negotiating inside.
It's already clear from the G20 summit in Italy that no matter what is agreed at COP26, global temperatures will continue to rise, affecting some communities more than others.
Failed climate policy that's existing right now that the world needs to know is on the backs of our indigenous peoples. It's going to devastate our food systems, our rising systems, our culture.
6 years since the landmark Paris Climate Accord, and the stakes have never been higher. And these protesters say, we can't have our leaders cop out now. Saeed Pourreza, Glasgow.
Meet Perkinra, an all-Iranian drug for treating rheumatoid arthritis in children. The drug is a new formulation of Anakinra, or what is internationally known as Kineret, which is a product of a Swedish pharmaceutical company. Iranian biotech firm Persisgen says Perkinra is the first Iranian biopharmaceutical medication that is developed from A to Z inside Iran.
The medicine had been tested on patients under 16 who needed intensive care in Tehran's Imam Hussein Hospital, where hospitalization rates had reduced by 65% after the clinical trial. He said half of the patients who avoided the medicine during the trial had died, while those taking the medication had seen their oxygen levels improve after 48 hours.
In rheumatoid arthritis, or shortly RA, the immune system attacks healthy cells in the body by mistake, causing painful swelling in the joints. In Iran, around 500,000 people are suffering from the condition. They get weekly injections of Kineret, the Swedish drug, which is highly unavailable in Iran due to U.S. sanctions that prevent the country from paying for foreign medicine.
By producing this medicine, Persisgen managed to break the monopoly of Sweden on the production of RA drugs. Plus, the import of the drug takes a complicated procedure given the fact that foreign companies shy away from selling medicine to Iran due to fear from U.S. punishment, and even if they want to, Iran cannot pay them because of the banking sanctions.
Persisgen says it has so far manufactured 60,000 syringes of Perkinra for distribution in the Iranian market. At the same time, it has initiated exports to three countries of Ukraine, Turkey, and the Philippines.
Prompted by years of U.S. sanctions that have blocked Iranians' access to life-saving medicine, Iran has been trying to gain self-sufficiency in the pharmaceutical sector. And this biotech firm says Perkinra is a byproduct of that pressure, which will now obviate the need for Iranian RA patients to desperately wait for foreign medicine. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
The Iran nuclear deal, known as the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, or the JCPOA, got into trouble in May 2018 when then-US President Donald Trump unilaterally abandoned it and reimposed sanctions on the Islamic Republic. In January this year, when Trump's successor, Joe Biden, took office, he expressed willingness to return to the deal. Accordingly, Tehran and the remaining JCPOA parties, namely China, Russia, the UK, France, and Germany, began talks in Vienna in April. Six rounds of negotiations were held before they were suspended in June due to Washington's failure to remove the sanctions. Now, Iran's foreign minister has questioned that whether the US is serious to return to the JCPOA.
If there is a serious will in Washington to return to the deal, there is no need for all these negotiations at all. It is enough for the U.S. president to issue an executive order tomorrow and announce that the U.S. is joining the pact from the point where the Trump administration left.
On Friday, the U.S. imposed fresh sanctions targeting Iran's drone program, a move drawing a reaction from the Iranian Foreign Ministry.
The imposition of new sanctions reflect the completely contradictory behavior of the White House, an administration that talks about returning to the JCPOA and is following the same methods of the Trump administration by imposing sanctions, is sending a message that it is not trustworthy at all.
Iran's drone program, along with its missile program, is among issues that the U.S. and some of its Western and regional allies say must be included in talks over the JCPOA. That's what Iran has time and again rejected, saying its defense program remains non-negotiable.
Iran's defense capability is a matter of national decision that is intertwined with the country's national interests and security. Therefore, no country has the right to speak or comment on this issue.
Iran says it is interested in continuing the Vienna talks, but the negotiations must be result-oriented and lead to the removal of the sanctions in a verifiable manner. However, the White House persists in exerting pressure on Iran to speed up the talks, a policy that Russia believes is unhelpful.
Pressure on Iran to speed up the experience shows that it doesn't help. Either you do it bilaterally or in the commission, or you do it through the IAEA.
Top officials within the Biden administration, including Secretary of State Antony Blinken, have admitted that the so-called maximum pressure campaign launched by Trump against Iran has failed. However, despite the admission, the White House seems to be still following up that proven failed policy.
of thousands of Palestinians are lining up in front of the chambers of commerce across the Gaza Strip, hoping to get permits from the Israeli side to walk in the occupied lands and the West Bank. This comes after Rahmer saying that more permits are set to be issued for the first time following the recent escalation on the Gaza Strip.
It is hard to believe that Israel is going to issue permits for us to work in occupied lands and the West Bank. Since 2019, no permission has been issued by Israel. We have been jobless since then. Now Israel says it is going to issue new permits, but it has set hard conditions for us.
In light of the deteriorating economic situation in Gaza with the high unemployment rate of more than 53% and poverty reaching about 70%, Palestinians hope to obtain the permits to find work opportunities in the occupied lands and the West Bank that will help them to reduce their poverty. Since Israel withdrew from the Gaza Strip in 2005, it no longer allowed Gaza workers to obtain permits that would enable them to work, as tens of thousands of workers used to go out daily to work in the occupied lands as their only source of income in the fields of construction, agriculture, industry, and tourism.
The Israeli blockade on the Gaza Strip has led to an unprecedented level of unemployment in the Gaza Strip. Meanwhile, about 70% of Palestinian families suffer from lack of food, and this is all due to the collapse of Gaza's economy.
The Chamber of Commerce says Israel should be held accountable for the growing rate of unemployment in Gaza. The daily hardships endured by Palestinians, along with the crippling blockade imposed on the Gaza Strip, led thousands to search for work opportunities outside Gaza. Palestinians called on the international community to end the siege and develop solutions to reduce high rates of poverty and unemployment. Ruba Shabet, Gaza.
This is IRIB English Radio.
Get up. Good morning.
Good morning. Your captain speaking, and we are currently cruising over Iranian skies.
شهید بهشتی مسافرین گرامی خواهشمند از جهت تعیین مسیر به تابلوهای راهنما توجه فرمایید.
Hello, good morning.
Good morning. How is everything?
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran.
IRIB English Radio.
On Fridays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah, the first before the bringing forth and the giving of life, and the last after the annihilation of all things. The All-Knowing who forgets not him who remembers him, and decreases not him who thanks him, and disappoints not him who supplicates him, and cuts not off the hope of him who hopes in him. O Allah, I call thee to witness, and thou art sufficient witness, and I call to witness all thy angels, and the inhabitants of thy heavens, and the bearers of thy throne, and thy prophets, and thy messengers, whom thou hast sent out, and the various kinds of creatures thou hast brought forth, that I bear witness that thou art Allah. There is no God but thou, thou alone, who hast no associate nor any equal, and thy word has no failing nor any change, and that Muhammad, Allah bless him and his household, is thy servant and thy messenger. He delivered to the servants that with which thou charged him, and he struggled for Allah as is his due. And he gave the good news of the truth of reward, and he warned of the veracity of punishment. O Allah, make me firm in thy religion as long as thou keepst me alive. And make not my heart to swerve after thou hast guided me, and give me mercy from thee. Surely thou art the giver. Bless Muhammad and the household of Muhammad, and make me one of his followers and his partisans, and muster me in his band, and give me the success of accomplishing the obligatory observance of Friday, and performing the acts of obedience which thou hast made incumbent upon me within it, and receiving the bestowal which thou hast apportioned for its people on the day of recompense. Thou, only thou, art the mighty ones.
Us out from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
It's been described as an abortive act of piracy. The IRGC Navy has foiled a U.S. attempt to steal Iranian oil from the Sea of Oman. The U.S. military confiscated the Iranian tanker loaded with crude oil in the Sea of Oman, but why would the U.S. do that? Maybe it's because it does not want Iran to sell or deliver its oil to anyone. But Iran has been warning for years that the U.S. presence in the Persian Gulf is a source of instability. In this edition of the Spotlight, we will look at the ramifications of this illegal act by the U.S.
We are the funding operation.
Iran's Islamic Revolution Guards Corps released a video on Wednesday which showed how its naval force foiled a recent U.S. attempt to steal a shipment of Iranian oil in the Sea of Oman. The IRGC said the Americans seized a tanker and transferred its cargo to another vessel to divert it to an unknown destination. The IRGC forces, however, managed to land on the deck of the second tanker and diverted it into Iran's territorial waters. U.S. forces unsuccessfully attempted to block the tanker's path using helicopters and warships. They also made another failed attempt to seize the tanker from entering the Iranian waters. The ship later docked in Bandar Abbas port on October the 25th.
This is an American invasion, a hostile action against Iranian interests. This would definitely escalate the tensions, but the purpose of such moves is very much clear, as Iran has been practicing resistance diplomacy to resist against the United States pressures, illegal sanctions.
The U.S. has been trying to prevent Iran from selling its oil since former President Donald Trump pledged to bring the country's crude exports to zero. This toes the lines of the so-called maximum pressure campaign Trump launched in 2018 following his unilateral withdrawal from the Iran nuclear deal. Last year, the Trump administration also threatened to deploy the U.S. Navy to the Caribbean Sea to stop Iran from delivering fuel shipments to Venezuela, but it failed to do so. Recently, when Iran began exporting fuel to Lebanon, the U.S. again vowed to impede the effort, but to no avail. Iran has time and again warned against U.S. adventurism in the West Asian region. Iranian officials say Tehran does not seek to get involved in a conflict with Washington, but will give a firm and crushing response to any military action. The recent confrontation in the Sea of Oman has highlighted Iran's military might and conveyed a message to the White House that the Iranian armed forces will not hesitate to defend the country and its interests.
Well, joining us for this edition of the Spotlight, we have Tim Anderson, Director of the Center for Counter-Hegemonic Studies. And also joining us is John Busnich, Journalist and Political Analyst.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Okay, I'd like to welcome you both. Tim Anderson, let me first start with you and get your reaction to this U.S. provocation in the Sea of Oman and U.S.'s attempt to steal an Iranian oil tanker.
Well, basically, we're often talking about the same theme when we talk about so-called American sanctions, which is actually, in strict legal terms, just high seas piracy. The United States does not have the legal power to seize cargo between two sovereign states on the high seas. The United States, however, operates as if it were some kind of a high seas sheriff that's appointed itself to bounty hunt the economic products of countries that it wants to put under political pressure. Obviously, Iran has no reason to submit to this kind of high seas terror pressure, and is doing the right thing by continuing to conduct its independent trade policy.
But it's confusing as to why, A, the U.S. would feel that way, and B, why it would go to the extent that it did in terms of what happened today. I mean, when we take a look at the confrontational nature between Iran and the U.S., given obviously not only their past, but also in that strategic waterway, doesn't it risk that escalating to an all-out war?
So I understand where you're coming from, because you're coming from the position of the average normal person who anticipates and who actually usually expects that two sides in a dispute both have legitimate interests at stake and are just arguing about the relative legitimacy of their interest. That is not the situation in this case. Naturally, Iran has its sovereign interests of conducting business internationally. However, the United States, and I often refer to it not as the United States, but as the Anglo-American Empire, is merely carrying on the tactics and the policies of the English Empire, which used this kind of provocation to encourage destabilization and to cause problems, allowing them to assert authority where there was none. And it's not a surprise that the Union Jack and the pirate flag, the Jolly Roger, were often stocked on the same boat, which in the daytime was serving as the English Navy ship, and at the nighttime was a pirate ship on the King's Commission. This is no different from history, and I don't understand why people can't remember our most recent past and apply it to today's events. This is the main issue here.
Okay. Tim Anderson, welcome. Looking at what has happened, first, let me get an idea from you, your reaction as to what Iran has said was this effort for piracy from the U.S.
Yes, well, I don't want to speculate on what was really behind this particular incident. It's not clear yet from the information why they would have done this, except I want to comment on the current situation of the U.S., which I believe is in a time of uncertainty where there's a partial strategic withdrawal from the region going on.
Looks like we lost Tim Anderson. So let me turn to you, John Bosnick. So, Tim Anderson, if you're back with us, go ahead. Continue.
Sorry. So I was saying that at this time, there are certain changes happening in the Biden administration, and on one side it has Israel with a fair degree of anxiety that the Biden administration may withdraw from the region. That's its main concern. And Israel has already, the Israeli leaders have already said to the Biden administration they should provoke Iran, they should go harder. Of course, Israelis don't want to do it themselves. They want the U.S. to carry out some sort of strike there. At the same time, the Biden administration has been talking about reverting to having its consulate in Jerusalem with a Palestinian brief because they're trying to keep alive the myth of two states, which is important to keep the liberal Zionists in on the picture there. At the same time, they've withdrawn from Afghanistan. They're reconsidering their situation in Syria and Iraq. And so it's a time of uncertainty for the Biden administration. I think this act today really was a blow to the morale and the prestige of the U.S. military in the region. And I think that may have an impact on the uncertainty and the contemplation of a partial strategic withdrawal.
What would U.S. officials who have spoken on the condition of anonymity say that the Iranian report was not true and there had been no American attempt to seize a tanker, Tim Anderson?
Well, it's routine that they deny these sorts of things. I think that I've seen some video of what appears to be a pursuit, but I can't comment on the detail. But it's absolutely routine that the U.S. would deny these things. They denied, after all, that anyone was hurt in Al-Assad airbase strike in early 2020, and later on we heard there was more than 100 that had concussive injuries from that. So I wouldn't take that too seriously.
Okay, John Bosnick, our guest Tim Anderson talks about Israel and the U.S. and what Israel wants the U.S. to do, which is something that Israel is not going to do, and that is to have the U.S. provoke Iran and then get into a military engagement, which I'm assuming that Israel may follow through after the U.S. commits itself militarily to Iran. Both have made threats against Iran. how do you view that in the context of what happened today?
Well, I mean, in the context of bad events, one could take minimal reassurance in the fact that Israel does not feel that it could get away with making a unilateral attack on Iran and surviving the PR blowout as a result. So, to whatever extent it has any value, the slow movement on the part of the United States to do Israel's dirty work by bombing Iran or in other ways attacking Iranian interests is acting as a potential break to a much more severe conflict. And I do not see a coalition of the willing taking shape here. I do not see a clamoring on the part of other countries to assist the United States and Israel on this pressure against
Why
Iran.
Is that?
And I think that, I think that people have wisened up. After the war on Iraq for non-existent weapons of mass destruction, after identical unproven claims against Iran, after interventions in eastern Ukraine, in the Donbass region, I think that the American people are getting a bit tired of war without end and war without cause. Mm-hmm. War without cause. And it's revealing more and more that the wars are not made in the interests of the people of any country, but they are made in the interest of the war-driven economy, the military-industrial complex, which simultaneously owns the media that tells the people what to think. And this is all part of an ecosystem, and at today's time and date, Iran is the target. That's how the system works, unfortunately for all of us.
Tim Anderson, the U.S. is time and again said that we do not want nor will allow the Iranian oil to go out into the market, whether Iran is going to deliver it, sell it, or in any form. It has issued warnings against Iran on that, and we know that simply when it came to delivering oil to Venezuela, if you recall, and more recently to Lebanon. And this is under the sanctions that it has imposed, but also under that U.S. maximum pressure campaign. But we see that sanction has been broken by Iran. Why does the U.S. insist to pursue that route when it has failed?
Well, you're right to point out that there's a great deal of continuity with the Biden administration and the Trump administration. In the Trump tore up the nuclear deal and proceeded into what he called this maximum pressure situation, which is effectively, of course, it's not sanctions at all. It's an economic siege. It's a blockade. It's grossly illegal. But, of course, those examples you mentioned, the oil to Venezuela, and Venezuela, by the way, its oil industry is recovering very strongly now as a result of that. The oil to Lebanon was not blocked, so the maximum pressure campaign might be there in words, but it's leaking very strongly. And remember that the U.S. had to create some new leaks in its campaign to allow the so-called Arab gas pipeline to come in as an alternative to Iranian oil from Jordan through Syria into Lebanon. So the U.S. was forced to back down in a number of those things. As I say, I think it's important because there is a strategic rethinking going on at the moment, which I believe began under the Trump administration, and Biden followed through with the withdrawal from Afghanistan. But the withdrawal from Afghanistan has consequences. It's weakened the U.S. hand against Iran, for one thing, because the Taliban, whatever we think of them, has worked to have a better relationship with Iran and a better relationship with China, and that's worked against U.S. strategic interests there. And Israel's relationship with the Biden administration is now under some strain. There's a fair degree of anxiety and shrillness coming from the Israeli side about what they would like to do. They'd like the U.S. to maintain its forces in the region when it's thinking to withdraw them, and they would like the U.S. to provoke Iran and do dirty work that the Israelis haven't got the stomach to do themselves.
John Bessage, I'm curious as to what the U.S. and Israel think when it comes to Iran's military might. I mean, you know, Iran is not the same Iran that it was 5 years ago, 10 years ago, or even a few years back. There's been lots of advances that Iran has made in the military arena, from its naval capabilities to its air force to even its forces on the ground. I mean, the U.S. war on Syria, along with its allies, in a sense, helped Iran in terms of its role that it played in fighting the Daesh terrorists. Does that figure in their calculations when they see the way that Iran has increased its capabilities, including the way that it handled the situation today?
Indeed, it does work into their calculations. But it works into their calculations in two ways. Number one, they use it as grounds to claim more money from their government and from their taxpayers to even greater expand American military power. If you get out of your head the idea that the governments of the world work in the interests of all the people in every country in the world, and that there are governments that do not do that, and they work in the interests of special interests, then you realize that Iran's buildup of its self-defense mechanisms is used to buy more weapons in the United States. But on the second side of the same coin, it does make a difference in the region, especially insofar as Israel appears to no longer believe it has the independent capacity to strike out against Iran by itself. So Iran's defense buildup has had the dampening factor on regionally led strikes that draw the United States into a conflict. So this is a beneficial defensive advancement on Iran's side.
Tim Anderson, we do have to talk about the region itself, this Persian Gulf region, the strategic waterway of the Strait of Hormuz, where you have a lot of oil pass through it. Iran has time and again throughout the years stated that we can handle the security in the region. And Iran says that not just us, but to involve regional countries in West Asia to participate in establishing that security, pointing to the U.S. as being a source of instability. If the U.S. is a source of instability, if you agree, then shouldn't the U.S. leave this region alone? It says it's in its plans to remove itself from West Asia, unless that's not the case.
Well, in an ideal world, of course, they should get completely out of West Asia. But I think in terms of the plan that they've been trying to pursue for the last 20 years at least, or a bit more really, they are realizing that there's a series of losing wars in which they're engaged. And the question is what to do about that. And the notion that I mentioned, the idea of a partial strategic withdrawal, which has been spoken of for at least 5 years in the US, and Trump tried a bit of it and didn't work, and Biden pursued it with the withdrawal from Afghanistan, the direct occupation withdrawal from Afghanistan. This all figures into a strategic positioning of the U.S. because, of course, let's remember, they are also seriously overextended as regards China. So they're trying to maintain this barrier between Russia and Europe. They're fighting a series of losing wars in West Asia, and they're making these provocative steps against China and threatening a war over Taiwan. Now, this is a serious overextension, and it's not that the U.S. administrators are stupid. They will be aware of this, and they'll be thinking about ways in which to deal with it. And the way that they typically deal with it is to palm it off to their so-called partners, that is to say their subordinate characters in the region, and this is what's been spoken on in West Asia. They can say, if we withdraw from Syria and Iraq, we will allow Erdogan in the north and the Saudis to fight over control of Syria and Iraq. Supposedly, that's still part of their game plan there, basically. The Israelis factor into that, and the Israelis, let's remember, are also in the Persian Gulf now. They're increasing their presence in the Emiratis. They're putting their media outfit into the UAE. They have a presence in North Iraq. They have a strong presence in Azerbaijan. In other words, Erbil on the edge of Iran and Azerbaijan on the north. There is an Israeli presence in the Gulf and in the north and the northwest of Iran now. So they'll be counting on that in a way to try and pursue whatever assets they have left in the region to carry on the work that they've failed to do in the last 20 years. And that, of course, includes Daesh, the ISIS, the version of Daesh that was set up and which they've been using in Afghanistan with terrible effects since they withdrew.
So what about that Council of the Willing, John Bostich? Is there a will on the countries in this region to really foresee that a war against Iran is going to benefit the region? I mean, a country like the UAE, shouldn't it think twice?
Yes.
Especially given that Israel has penetrated into its intelligence apparatus. Did the UAE foresee any of this happening? as an example.
Once again, we are getting into this same problem of presuming that political and economic colony countries actually think for themselves. They don't. They receive a set of instructions from the leader of their particular alliance, and they follow the instructions. If they want to not come under kind of political pressure first, then economic sanctions, like the ones that have been pursued against Iran for decades, or eventually military intervention. And this is the way the world is run today, and more people are understanding this. And this is the important, hopeful way out. The more the public understands that wars are contrived to make profit and not created to defend national real interests in the region, the less likely it is that the United States can get any support from other countries except, of course, Israel. And that symbiotic relationship needs to come under more scrutiny, both in the United States and in Israel, because it's highly scrutinized now all around the rest of the world.
Thank you. We're going to end it there. That's John Busnich, journalist and political analyst from Belgrade. Tim Anderson, a pleasure, director at the Center for Counter-Hegemonic Studies from Damascus. With that, we come to an end for this edition of The Spotlight. It was great having you. Until next time, I'm Kavit Ali. See you then.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Limelight. 7 out of 8 members of a military jury called for clemency to be granted in the case of a Guantanamo detainee in light of his detention without due process, and said his abuse at the hands of the CIA was closer to torture performed by the most abusive regimes in modern history rather than the euphemistic enhanced interrogation techniques claimed by the agency. Dear listeners, what you heard was part of an article written by Andrea Germanis, journalist. This article is published under the heading Gitmo Jurors Liken CIA Torture to Acts by Most Abusive Regimes in Modern History. Stay tuned for more. Seven out of eight members of a military jury called for clemency to be granted in the case of a Guantanamo detainee in light of his detention without due process and said his abuse at the hands of the CIA was closer to torture performed by the most abusive regimes in modern history rather than the euphemistic enhanced interrogation techniques claimed by the agency. The treatment of Mr. Han in the hands of U.S. personnel should be a source of shame for the U.S. regime. The call from the military officials, the New York Times reported recently, came in a handwritten letter to the senior official reviewing the case of 41-year-old Majid Khan, whom the jury sentenced recently to 26 years in prison. The jurors in their letter said the denial of basic due process for Khan was an affront to the concept of justice. Sentencing followed his landmark testimony about the brutality he endured at secret CIA sites for 3 years, beginning in 2003 until he was taken to Guantanamo in 2006. The details of his torture first emerged in 2015. Khan's accounts to jurors last week included being raped by CIA medics, waterboarded, hung naked from a ceiling beam, and chained to the floors for days. The more I cooperated and told them, Khan said at a hearing, the more I was tortured. The juror's letter dated recently stated that they recommend clemency and noted that Khan committed serious crimes against the U.S. and partner nations for which he pled guilty, that he expressed remorse for the impact of those actions, and that he's cooperating with prosecutions. Khan was subjected to physical and psychological abuse that was of no practical value in terms of intelligence or any other tangible benefit to U.S. interests, the letter stated. Instead, the seven jurors wrote, "It is a stain on the moral fiber of America. The treatment of Mr. Khan in the hands of U.S. personnel should be a source of shame for the U.S. government." Born in Pakistan, Khan came with his family to the U.S. and grew up and graduated high school outside Baltimore. He returned to Pakistan in his early 20s to get married. He has admitted to being a courier for Al-Qaeda. Khan was a vulnerable target for recruitment to terrorist activities. The jurors rose because of his young age and because he was still mourning the loss of his mother. The jurors also deemed Khan not a threat for future extremism. According to the New York-based Center for Constitutional Rights, part of the team representing Khan, the 2012 plea deal he reached with the U.S. government supersedes the 26-year sentence he was dealt last week, meaning he should be released in February 2022. Despite former President Barack Obama's campaign vow to close the prison, Guantanamo is now in its 20th year. Wells Dixon, a senior attorney with the Center for Constitutional Rights who represents Khan, said in a statement recently, "We look forward to working with the Biden administration to ensure that when Majid is transferred from Guantanamo at the conclusion of his sentence in February, he has the necessary support to allow him to move on with his life and be a positive, contributing member of society."
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.